This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. Our guests this morning are Michael Mayer, Legal Director and Director of the Water for Washington campaign at the Washington Environmental Council, and Darcy Nonnemaker, Associate Director for Washington Water Policy at American Rivers. Michael and Darcy are here today to tell us about the challenges of ensuring an adequate supply of fresh water in Washington State and to discuss solutions outlined in the recent report, Before the Wells Run Dry, Water Solutions for Washington. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
Would you start with an overview of how we use fresh water in Washington State? Who are the major user groups here?
Well, I think a couple of the major use groups are agriculture, municipal, and industrial. I think that captures sort of a large bulk of the water use. But that really is dominated by agriculture. I think 3/4 or so of the water that comes out every day is devoted to agriculture, and that's pretty consistent west-wide. We have about 2 million irrigated acres of agriculture in Washington, and it demands quite a bit of fresh water.
And could you compare the water use pattern in eastern compared to western Washington?
A lot of the irrigated agriculture is going on the east side of the Cascades, where precipitation is often 5 to 8 inches. I mean, it's a semi-arid environment. It's very suitable for growing. You do have a fair amount of industry out there devoted to wheat, to alfalfa, to grapes, but it is demanding on freshwater supplies, and Washington has a long history of irrigated agriculture. On the west side, that's less so. We do have an agricultural industry here. It's not often as dependent on irrigation, and the irrigation demands are just less.
Yeah, and I would just say in western Washington, you have pretty significant urban population centers. You have Tacoma, Seattle, Bellingham, all sort of on the western side of the state, but the eastern side of Puget Sound. So I think the municipal supply and the domestic use in western Washington is particularly concentrated.
Who controls access to water in Washington State?
Well, I think a lot of that goes to how western water law operates. And I don't want to get too complex with this, but the way things work, and it's sort of divided the west side of the 100th Meridian, somewhere around the Rocky Mountains. On the west side, it's called the prior appropriation doctrine. And it's basically the first person who gets the water, who puts it to use, is the person who is most senior, who has the ability to use that right to the exclusion of people who come later in time. So a lot of people who came to the state, some of the early pioneers, even pre-statehood, those folks who started building the diversions, who started using the water and often were irrigating fields using flood irrigation, pouring a lot of water onto the crops, they have a right that extends back, you know, the earliest in time. And those are the people who claim a lot of the rights. And those are the rights that are still in place today. We don't always know the exact contours of those rights, particularly because the paper trail is not as clear as after we started a more formalized permitting system. But that's largely where a lot of these irrigated rights come from.
And I think one important sort of foundation to the water debate is that in Washington, the water resources belong to the public, and that the state has authority to manage those water resources on behalf of the public. And then you have these sort of individuals or users that will have their rights, which follows the scheme that Michael outlined. And over time, it's an incredibly complicated issue because people grow to have expectations on that water source. I don't know if your listeners have read the most recent edition of Business Week. Their cover story is about water, and the title is There Will Be Water. And I think there was a line that's often used in Western water debates about whiskey is for drinking and water is for fighting. So that sort of gives you an indication of the system.
No, we're seeing more and more stories, I think, showing up in the popular press as water sort of achieves, I think, the same prominence as oil as being determinative of what our society is going to look like going forward. You now see articles that are using the theme peak oil, and now we have peak water, too. People are talking about water in that same sense because it is a natural resource. It's more abundant in some places than it is in others. It's fundamental to how society grows and how it changes and how it adapts to the future. And it's finite. We don't have this endless supply. We have the same amount of water today that we've had for the last 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 years. And yet we have more people moving into Washington State, and we have climate change that is altering the patterns of how water is stored as snow up in the Cascades, our precipitation patterns. So it's shaking up a lot of the assumptions we've had around water, And it's making people rethink how we manage our water supplies in Washington.
And I just want to add real quickly, too, the comparison between water and oil is sort of interesting for me because oil has alternatives. But with water, there are no alternatives. We need it to sustain all sorts of life and all sorts of functions in our communities, and there's no alternative. So we really need to be smart and careful with how we manage it.
Which government agencies are responsible for helping to see that we have adequate water in Washington state?
No, that's an excellent question. Part of the issue is that there is a certain amount of finger-pointing that goes on with water management. So, for instance, the Department of Ecology is the one that thinks the most about and has a responsibility for managing water quantity. Is there enough water in the streams? Is there enough water coming out for a particular user group? Is somebody wasting water? Has somebody given up a water right that they're now claiming a right to? And that is the Department of Ecology's domain. On the other hand, the Department of Health is very much concerned with water quality issues. And in thinking about, is the water that is coming out of the streams or coming out of the ground sufficient for the people who need it for drinking water, for their showers, for washing dishes, for, you know, sort of the day-to-day domestic use? And then the counties and the cities have some responsibility in the development that takes place within their boundaries. And so they're responsible for saying, well, if we build this, is there going to be sufficient water for the people to go forward? But in many cases, these groups aren't talking adequately. So a county can be giving out a building permit for development in a rural area, but they're not thinking about whether or not there is an adequate water supply when you're thinking about the water rights. When you're thinking about this prior appropriation doctrine that I mentioned before, is there a legal right to water? You may be able to drill and access water physically, but is there really a water as a legal concept because there are these more senior users who can claim it? So the Department of Health and the community are thinking more about that issue, while the Department of Ecology is thinking more about the legal entitlement to the water. If all these people aren't having sort of an open, transparent discussion, you can get a lot of people just sort of pointing fingers back and forth, and then you have the development going forward, and you don't have adequate water supplies. In some states like Arizona, where they are, I think, very conscious of every drop of water, there are areas of the state in which you need to prove up that there is a century's worth of water for you to be able to go forward with your development. I mean, it's a very forward-thinking element because they know their water supplies are very, very much limited. I don't think we've hit that point in Washington in which we are that conscious of our water supplies. I think we're getting there, but I think we're better off if we step in before that happens.
And not to add another layer of complexity into this situation, but I think the federal agencies, while they may not have a direct regulatory role, have sort of an interesting role in the context of the Endangered Species Act. And we have, for example, Puget Sound Chinook salmon and salmon species across the state listed under the Endangered Species Act and in need of special protections. And in fact, the National Marine Fisheries Service, in their supplement to the Salmon Recovery Plan, mentioned an urgent and inescapable need to make sure that we have adequate stream flows or basically enough water in the stream to support salmon recovery and support aquatic species that live in our rivers and streams.
What do you see as the key threats to our water supply?
I think the two that people are most conscious of right now are the facts of population growth and the increasing impacts of climate change. I don't know if I would say those are threats exactly, but they're stressors. They're disrupting the status quo as it is right now. I think the estimates are probably in the next 30 years, we're going to get another 2 million people in Washington. A lot of that concentrated in the Puget Sound region. With climate change, we're already seeing declining snowpack. It's going to change the timing of when we see water. I mean, the big issue is the areas that are accustomed to slower releases of water out of that snowpack. The snowpack is, in a sense, natural storage. It carries us over through the summer when we're not otherwise getting a lot of precipitation. We're going to see that water running off a lot sooner. And the snowpack is not going to be as robust as it has been in the past. It's a big change. I mean, it's upsetting a lot of the status quo. So it's forcing people to sit back and say, are we managing our water the way we need to grow the way we need to, and yet retain the things that make Washington so special? The rivers and streams that are part of Washington, I think, are really part of Washington's identity, whether you're talking about salmon, whether you're talking about recreational opportunities, whether you're talking about sport fishing or commercial fishing. It really is just part of Washington's history. I think it's inescapable. But if we just sort of thoughtlessly assume that we can keep pulling water out of the stream or take water out of these aquifers without a plan for what Washington needs to look like, then we're going to find ourselves generations down the road in which we don't have sustainable rivers and streams.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree with that. I think that with population change, there's sort of a weird mix there, because when people move in, your landscape changes. They build homes, they build different types of facilities to provide services, et cetera. And inherently, that means you're changing the hydrology or the water cycle in that area. So you're going to have concentrated times of stormwater runoff just inundating rivers and streams and completely altering and changing that ecosystem in the way it usually functions. And that is a challenge. But in addition to that, you have this water supply component. You have more people. You have more people drinking water. You have more people washing their dishes. So how do you accommodate that supply? And within this legal framework that we've outlined, that's very complicated as well, and promote the right types of water supply tools while also considering climate change and sort of the variability and uncertainty of the future with our climate and how our water resources are going to react to that. So I think that's a huge issue. And people move here because it's beautiful. They move here because of the quality of life, as Michael mentioned. So I think maintaining that quality of life as well is just sort of a third complicating layer onto this debate.
I'm Diane Horn, and we are speaking with Darcy Nonnemaker, Associate Director for Washington Water Policy at American Rivers, and Michael Mayer, Legal Director and Director of the Water for Washington Campaign at the Washington Environmental Council. Our topic is the report, Before the Well Runs Dry, Water Solutions for Washington. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. What are some signs that we are beginning to run short of fresh water?
Well, I would say the one that is, I think, the most arresting is that we do have rivers and streams that run dry at times of the year when they shouldn't or when they haven't historically. That, I think, is the one that I think is most startling to people. But in general, I think, as Darcy also indicated, we have a real problem with our salmon populations. And I believe 14 or so listed in Washington State, and the National Marine Fisheries Service has been clear time and time again that low stream flows are a limiting factor. In other words, low stream flows are what are preventing those salmon stocks from being able to rebound from their current populations. And that's a good indicator of stream health. And a lot of the conversations that we're trying to have are about making people aware of the costs that are involved here, that we can't just keep pulling water out of the rivers and streams without us seeing consequences like that. If Washington is going to turn a blind eye to that, then we're going to find ourselves with more streams running dry, with more populations of salmon dropping off. So it's making sure that people are aware of the limitations in our water supply.
I would add that our Department of Ecology has also, in a number of basins, found that those basins are over-appropriated. In other words, there's no more water to give. In fact, we've gone over our limits. And so I think that that is a big sign when you're starting to reach that wall as a regulator, you know, at the Department of Ecology, trying to make those decisions. That's a big sign that something's happening and that there's an issue with this resource. And also recently, you know, some folks have probably heard about what's happening in Kittitas County with concerns about taking water out of groundwater aquifers through permit-exempt wells and the impact on surface water streams, and cities like Roslyn having a lot of uncertainty in terms of their water supply and where that is coming from. So, you know, I think the signs are all around us that there's a critical issue around water.
Yeah, I think Darcy's reference to Roslyn is very apt. I mean, the city of Roslyn, which many people know from its prominence in the TV series Northern Exposure,
right,
or at least people of a certain age or familiar with reruns, the town has been there since the late 1800s. It has a water right that is, I believe, 1908 or so. I mean, an early water right, I think, by most people's estimates. And yet, when there are droughts or near droughts or when water supplies are tight, they are subject to being cut off. Because there is so much agriculture in that Kittitas Valley, because those water rights are very senior, 1905 and earlier, that a 1908 right may find itself on the short end. And the prior appropriation system, the way it works in Washington water law, is very uncompromising. If you are later in line, if you're later in the chain, if you got there after a lot of these big water users and they need the water, they take it first. They have no obligation to help you out if you came to the party a little late. And that's difficult for people to understand. And at the same time, in Kittitas, there's a huge amount of development going on where people are drilling what are called permit-exempt wells. And those wells can be drilled without having to go to the Department of Ecology and saying, is there water available? It's presumed that the water can be accessed. And at the same time, those wells are very junior in the system. And the Department of Ecology has been quoted in the press as saying there's a palpable risk of these people being cut off in the future. Is that a smart way for us to grow? Are we setting up a system in which unsuspecting home buyers 10, 15 years down the road are going to find themselves without access to the water that they need? I mean, this just goes back to, I think, that we need to take affirmative steps before we find ourselves having overcommitted in terms of where people are and what water they're using and what salmon populations and what rivers are going to be put at risk.
And one other thing I would add, I think it's sort of part of this conversation, and we've touched on it a little bit, but just because you're in eastern or western Washington, there's really not a fundamental difference in terms of the water supply concerns and issues that face our communities. So I think just because we're in rainy Seattle, for example, you shouldn't assume that there's no water supply issues, because there certainly are. Although, you know, Seattle tends to be, as a city, better at managing the resource and conserves more of the resource for in-stream uses. I think you can't assume. We still have the same problems, the same water shortages in the West that we do in the East.
No, I think it's a great point. The issue is often one of perception, that a lot of people think, oh, well, it's so rainy out here on the West Side that we have more water than we know what to do with. Why can't we give out more water rights? And it's really when that water is available and when people are most likely using that water. And as everybody knows, in the summer months, at least typically in the summer months, maybe not this summer, we have long stretches without much precipitation at all. And that's also the time when it's going to be hotter and drier and sunnier. People are more likely to be using water for irrigating their lawns. That's the time of year in which there is more substantial irrigation for crops, for the ag that is taking place in western Washington. So it's those pinch points. And it's also a critical time for salmon, whether mm-hmm. they are moving upstream to spawn or if the younger salmon are in stream and waiting to go back out to the ocean. They need cool, clear water to be able to survive and avoid predators. So if the streams are running dry in those, I guess, pinch points in the summer, then you have a problem. I mean, even if the stream looks great for 3/4 of the year, if you're wiping it out during the summer, then you don't have a healthy functioning stream.
Yeah, and in western Washington, the other component that we touched on earlier as well is the urban development. You have all this runoff. It's sort of both ends of the spectrum. I mean, you tend to have dry summers that will decrease the water that is in stream for salmon and for aquatic species. And then you'll also have during rain events an inundation of water in the stream that will completely alter, again, that stream and the life in that stream that, you know, that depend on sort of slower, reliable cycles of water. So I think that's important consideration.
Well, you've been alluding to this, but what do you see as the shortcomings in our current policies and management of water in Washington State?
Well, in the report, we outlined a couple of those. I think there are a number of ways you can group them, and it's something we've been looking at for a number of years at Washington Environmental Council, and I think American Rivers has been doing so independently. Finally, we started having some conversations and realized that our interests were very much overlapping. So the three that we noted most prominently, first of all, is just the information needs that are compelling. The fact is it's very difficult to manage water if you don't know who's using what, when, how much you have left in your rivers and aquifers. There are big holes around that. One piece is just metering, you know, who is using what water when. We're moving forward on a lot of the metering to do with individual homes, but for a long time, there were some major cities in Washington in which people paid a flat rate for the amount of water they used in their homes, which I think everybody recognizes that doesn't send the sort of price signals that you want for people to use water conservatively, for people to use water recognizing that it is a valuable resource. The other aspect of monitoring is just making sure that you have stream flows that are being monitored, that you have aquifers that are being monitored, that you know you're not what some people call overmining your aquifers, that they're not dropping so precipitously that you're not going to have available groundwater. Those are some of the information needs. The other one is, like I mentioned, for information, is that a lot of these water rights are very ill-defined or based on a piece of paper that dates back to pre-statehood. You know, finding out exactly how much water really is being used by some of these users who have a very senior right, but like I said, the paper trail just isn't as well defined. Some of the basic environmental protections I think we still need. The idea that I think Darcy mentioned is that a lot of areas are quote-unquote over-appropriated. We're taking out more water than we can if we want to have a sustainable, healthy stream. So it's the Department of Ecology saying, well, this is the minimum amount of water that we need to stay in stream for it to be a functioning river system. That in itself is a water right. It's a very junior water right in the sense that those senior water rights can still take all the water that they need, but you're saying, you know, no more water. can come out of this system without us compromising the values that make it a productive watershed. And then the last one is accountability. There needs to be ongoing enforcement. There needs to be the sense that somebody is minding the store. I mean, people are acting very rationally, and if someone is out assuming that everybody around them is using water illegally, taking more water than they're entitled to, then that person's probably going to do the same. I mean, you need some sense that there is an enforcement body out there. And it's not a role our state has traditionally been very affirmative about. And some of that has to do with the politics around that and the fact that the state legislature has steered ecology away from enforcing. But if everybody knows that their neighbor is playing by the rules, they're more inclined to play by the rules themselves.
And I would just add, under the basic information step, one key bit of information that we need is, what is our demand going into the future? And the only way you really can do that is if you look at a well-measured and accounted-for system. But in addition to that, looking at other tools like conservation and efficiency, and that the role that that will play in helping to manage your demand over the long haul. And then in terms of environmental protections, you know, it's interesting in the Puget Sound region, for example, there are a number of watersheds or a few watersheds that don't have in-stream flow rules, which are basically the baseline, the floor, you know, the least amount of water that you should have in a river for it to be functional. And from American River's perspective, you need an ecologically protective flow. And so you really need the amount of water that can help the ecosystem function like it should, because that's really a bellwether for our local communities as well in terms of how healthy we're functioning. What is our quality of life? And then in addition to that, with the accountability, there is an interesting aspect of old water law that allows water masters to be located in different watersheds or river systems to be the enforcement officer, if you will. And the state hasn't necessarily made the commitment to putting water masters in every watershed, but you know, we certainly think that that would be a great help in having someone there looking at the system and figuring out what is happening.
You can kind of analogize that to your local sheriff. I mean, it's somebody who, you know, is familiar with the immediate area, who sort of walks the ditches, as they say, and makes themselves known to people and doesn't have to go in there with an enforcement stick, but can at least go knock on somebody's door and have a conversation about, you know, are you using too much? Is this within your water right? But it's a way to just make sure that things are working as they should, that there's not too much play in the system. But enforcement is one of those pieces that we do think more attention needs to be paid.
Yeah, that sort of brings it back to the basic information. You know, if people understood that water resources really belong to everyone in the state and we could take ownership of our water resources, we could be our own water masters, perhaps. But, you know, I think that enforcement and accountability isn't about having someone sort of pointing a finger at you and waving it at all times saying you're doing the wrong thing. We all take ownership in this. We really need to make sure that we have water for future generations.
What do you see as the biggest challenges to having adequate water in Washington State?
That's a big question. There are a number of challenges. I think one of them, unfortunately, is this system of prior appropriation. Because it has been in place for so long, you know, it's antiquated. It's based on early settlers moving in. A lot of miners in California, I think, sort of first pioneered this notion of first in time, first in right, is one of the sort of catchphrases that's used. But the idea is, you know, you've put the time and energy into pumping water out and putting it to some sort of use. You did it first, so sort of a finder's keepers. There is a property right involved in that. You have that right. It is protected by the Constitution. So people feel very much entitled to that. But as Darcy notes, water does belong to the public. So what the right really is you have the right to use water for a specific purpose. So if you, in fact, need less water to accomplish that purpose, if you could, for instance, grow your crops using less water, using more efficient infrastructure to do it, if you're using something other than flood irrigation, you know, you're using drip irrigation, which you can use much less water in doing so, then you really shouldn't have a right to as big a water right as you have been claiming from early on. The problem is that water has become very valuable and it can be sold, you know, it can be traded on the market. So people very much think, well, I could use less, but then I want to be able to sell off that block of water to somebody else and be able to make some money on it. You know, that's a little contrary to the way the system is supposed to work. I mean, the system is supposed to keep water moving from people to other uses if they don't necessarily need it. But we're stuck with the system we have, and that system has been in place since the turn of the century. There are a lot of water users out there who are using big blocks of water and very much feel entitled to it. They are very protective of the status quo, and it's going to take a little bit for them to think differently, because Western water law is familiar. I mean, it's comfortable. I don't think anybody would design the current system if they were building water law from the ground up. But people sort of know how this one works. What we're arguing is there are ways for us all to be better off, for us to all be able to accomplish our ends, for us to continue to have a sustainable agricultural industry in Washington, for us to have cities and communities that can grow within reason, that we do have the natural resources, that we have the recreational opportunities that we're accustomed to, that we have something of a commercial fishing industry, that we can do these things, but we have to start looking at water differently to do it.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And I think population growth only exacerbates that expectation because, you know, someone's building a house and they just assume, like anyone would, unless you're maybe a hydrologist or something, but you assume that the water is there or that someone will provide the water from somewhere else, but that, you know, everything will end up okay. And it's hard to change that perspective. It's the American dream in people's minds that they should have this property and be serving it with water. But the reality is we can't keep going down this road. It's not just about that one homeowner. It's about the whole cumulative impact of everyone draining this water resource or water resources in the state. And I think climate change also provides another challenge and another hurdle, but another opportunity as well, because climate change has been sort of framed as an emissions reduction issue. And from my perspective, climate change is also about building your resilience and your ability to adapt to the impacts that we're already feeling, frankly, from climate change. So what we need to do is make a commitment now to beef up our river systems, if you will. Coming from a vegetarian, I think that's a very strange term. But at any rate, I think the point is that we need to make sure our river ecosystems are healthy and functioning and have enough water to meet both human needs and natural environmental needs, because that's only going to serve us in the future as our climate is changing and our snowpack is reduced. And a lot of those questions and variables mean we need to have a lot of resilience.
Well, we're out of time, but just very briefly, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
One issue is, I think, just raising awareness. We would love people to get engaged on water issues. And whether that means just becoming more attuned to what's going on, keeping abreast of things that are going on in the paper. Also, finding out where your water comes from, finding out what your water supplier is doing about issues like conservation. For Seattle, the answer may be they're doing great things. For other communities, you may be able to push them in a direction to do a little more. The other one is the personal conservation. I mean, people can do a lot about their own water use. And for indoors, that's front-loading washers, that's using your dishwasher to maximize its efficiency. But the huge one is outdoor use. Think about your lawn and how you're using water out on the grass. Think about native plants. Think about xeriscaping. Think about ways in which you don't have to irrigate outside anymore. That's a really big piece of residential water use.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I mean, I think we all have a reason why we live here. Again, I said this earlier, it's a great place to live. We love to fish. We love to boat. We love to hike. It's a very outdoor-based community. And so we can really tap into that, I think. I think it means that we not only are educated, but we use that personal connection to communicate with our elected officials about why this really matters. And it's not just recreation, it's our drinking water. It is what helps sustain us. So I think we need to really emphasize the importance of water resources with our elected officials and make sure that they know what we know about water resources. We can all sort of keep each other accountable and educated.
Well, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We have just been speaking with Michael Mayer, Legal Director and Director of the Water for Washington Campaign at the Washington Environmental Council, and Darcy Nonnemaker, Associate Director for Washington Water Policy at American Rivers. For more information, check on the web at www.waterforwashington.org. Again, that's waterforwashington.org. You may also call the Washington Environmental Council at area code 206-631-2600 and American Rivers at area code 206-213-0330. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on 90.3 FM and kexp.org.